Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little piss, my foot on the spine.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes, and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. For the uninitiated, we take a look at all of Alan Partridge's vehicles, TV, book, live show, etc. Taking a look under the bonnet, sometimes we have to take the driving gloves off when a particular vehicle is in need of a service, but ultimately, we're all admirers of the handiwork. So if you're joining us for the first time, you can dive into past episodes where we've already covered the day-to-day, knowing me, knowing you. I'm Alan Partridge, Mid-Morning Matters, Alpha Papa, iPartridge, Nomad, Open Book, Scissor Dial this time, Alan's live stand-up appearances, Stratagem, Alan's comic relief contributions, and we've spoken to Simon Greenall, aka Michael the Geordie, Tim Key, aka Sidekick Simon, Stephen Mangan, aka Sexy Dan, and Susanna Fielding, aka Jenny Gresham, and a host of famous journalists, comedians, and presenters about their love of Alan. So to round off this labour driving metaphor, allow me to introduce your four main spanners. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Would it be terribly rude to stop listening to you and go and speak to somebody else?
Nick Older.
While they have to choose between eating and heating, I'll forgo Dutchie pork sausages in favour of less expensive brands that mince up cheaper bits of the pig.
And Tom Stab.
She likes help for heroes. And Cafe Nero's.
So welcome back, everyone. We've never left it this long without a Monkey Tennis. So thank you for rejoining us. We've got a little older. We've just got a little older. That's it, really. So huge thanks to everyone that's been asking for our return. We have had many, many messages while we've been off air, so to speak, and a couple of examples of those coming up. As seasoned listeners will know, we like to start every series with a roundup of your feedback. So we've got tits bits from you about various parts of Alan canon, and also looking forward to some of the things that we'll be covering this series. Spoiler alert, we'll be starting with From the Yost House Series 3, or Series 2, Tranche 2, depending on who you speak to. But before we get into that, it's feedback time, and we're going to start with someone who's got in touch with Mr. Tom Dark.
Yeah, I think this is quite a good indication of a lot of the feedback we've had over the last 12, 13, 14 months, however long it's actually been. This was an email from McNeil Chapman, and he writes, "You all have two APU issues in your charge currently, namely Osthaus Series 2 Tranche 2 and Big Beacon. I recommend you start with the former, but beggars can't be choosers. My livelihood and sleep are literally suffering with waiting for the pod to start up again. I will be forced to send you a bill for my lost wages unless you start your important work again. Cheers, McNeil from San Francisco."
Of course, trust an American to threaten you with litigation immediately.
But I do like that. Literally, his work is suffering because we haven't been podcasting. Didn't expect that.
Well, on that theme, James Coughlin has written in and he says, "I think your commentary is best with a bit of retrospective, or retrospective, if you will. I think reviewing the series straight after is too soon. We don't get time to digest it, form our own opinions, and then compare notes with your insights. Plus, we can enjoy the podcast, and once that's settled down, we get another series of your twaddle to enjoy a few weeks or months later. So, yeah, take as long as you like, and will Wally Banter be filling in?" So, yeah, another listener there. Quite happy for us to take our time.
Well, he'll be very pleased about this then.
And it will be twaddle.
Yep.
We got another message from one of our listeners, Daniel Sumpton, who messages on Facebook, and he says, "Hi guys, happy new year. I hope all is well. We haven't heard from you guys in a while." Another concerned listener here. "I just wanted to say a big thank you for all the amazing episodes over the years. I've listened to every Ruddy episode several times, bloody hell, and it never gets boring. Do you have any plans for future installments? If not, a great big thank you for all your hard work. Oh, and I saw this in Waterstones at Christmas and thought of you." We'll share this on socials, but Daniel has sent in a picture of the front cover of Alan's latest non-fiction work. That's autobiography, non-fiction, not quite sure what we're calling it. Big Beacon, on the shelves of Waterstones.
We'll get to that in the next series, I guess.
We'll get to that. On the shelves of Waterstones, right next to the autobiography of Elon Musk. Now, they are both sort of the respective authors' faces, and they have their hands in a sort of prayer gesture, and there is absolutely no way that Steve and the Gibbons haven't lifted that directly from the Elon Musk autobiography, because it is absolutely uncanny and brilliant. So we will share that on the socials, and you can judge for yourself.
I think there's a bit of a trope where a lot of kind of autobiographies have this cover stance, it's not kind the of bouncing around cover stance,
like
the prayer,
yeah,
almost
the
a musing, prayer cover stance.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I reckon eagle-eyed listeners could probably find some other covers which have the same Big Beacon stance. I think Steve and the Gibbons know exactly what they're doing with that.
But also, I really hope that someone at Waterstones has placed these next to each other on purpose rather than Daniel spotting it and then moving it and putting it over, because that really is just a little bit of fun that the Waterstones staff are having.
So for those of you champing at the bits to discuss and celebrate Big Beacon, we'll be going through your feedback, obviously. Then we'll be talking about From the Osthaus Series 3. And then later in the year, we're going to tackle Alan's third tome, or fourth if you count Bouncing Back, or fifth if you count the other little one that he mentioned at one point. So we'll be tackling Big Beacon later in the year. But right now, I wanted to go back to a discussion we had around a Variety article where the new head of Baby Cow at the time was discussing the possibilities of a sort of Alan in America style series. So on that topic, Miguel Guido Pereira got in touch and said, "Re-AP going to the US. Following his network-like outburst at the end of this time, do you think there's much mileage in him becoming a Farage Morgan-style British personality that tells it like it is, talking head on a Fox-esque news channel? Or considering his populist turn at the end of this time with Alan Partridge, I can see him getting caught up in the sense-making circle jerk that is the intellectual dark web YouTube circuit, Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, et al. You know the ones, ruddy idiots, the lot of them." So yeah, I mean, I can kind of see them going down this route, but I feel like if they were going to go for this sort of Fox talking head GB News thing, they would have done it by now. I feel like that ship has sailed, even in terms of sort of parody. It's kind of been around for so long. I also think that these days Alan's more of a nuanced character. I don't know that he would really fit into a sort of GB News, Fox, even LBC mould. Keen to hear your thoughts.
I mean, I think we've discussed this a few times around Stratagem, where it felt like Stratagem could have been the vehicle that would have facilitated this kind of character development. I think particularly, as Miguel rightly says, the network-like outburst at the end of this time feels like it would have led onto that perfectly. Perhaps they didn't do that because it felt too obvious, but I think the fact that it wasn't done at that time does feel a bit like this kind of Fox News idea, GB News type thing. Yeah, it's almost a bit like, if they haven't done it by now, I feel like it's not going to happen.
I think if you're going down the route of Alan in America, then you have to sort of dial it all up to 11, don't you? Because of what American TV is like and how this kind of avenue for Partridge would need to fit into that sort of fit into that mold of that kind of, like I say, brash media personality. And that's actually the Alan over the years that I've come to like the least and prefer the more subtle, nuanced kind of Alan that we have seen in recent years. So I would prefer it not to go down this route because I don't think it's the kind of Alan that I would particularly like. It would be the cartoonishness of sort of older times Partridge that I don't think has aged quite as well.
That's the only way I think they could make this work is if they took the nuanced sort of slightly more wants to be liberal Partridge, had him basically rejected by the BBC, picked up by an American network, and then put under pressure to become more polarising. To stir up more debate, to go back to that sort of cartoonish Partridge that he was. And then that kind of internal wrestling of like, does he have any morals or does he just want to be on TV at all costs? Like the idea of him trying to stir up two opposing talking heads in a studio, I can see some appeal to that, but only if there's that struggle behind the camera.
However, one thing I would really like to see is Lynn get corrupted by Hollywood. I think that would be very, very funny.
On the subject of Alan in America, or America Alan, as I like to call it, Jamie Atkinson on Twitter sent us a message along this theme, writing about Toast of London. So with Toast, they did the UK character Goes to America premise for Toast of Tinseltown in, I think, early 2022. So Jamie writes, I'm a bit dubious about Alan doing something similar. Guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I don't think I've seen Toast of Tinseltown, so I don't know if anyone else in the group has. So I don't really know what that setup would be.
Toast of Tinseltown was really weird because you had this incredibly quirky British character that felt relatively small and quite London, you know, features and looms large in it. And then it's a bit of a kind of holiday on the buses where it didn't really make much sense. And I kind of got the impression that maybe Matt Berry has just got friends in America now that were just keen to make this rather than it made sense as a story on paper. I have to confess, I love Toast. I also have to confess, I couldn't finish it. It was that good.
I don't think this must have happened at the same around the time when obviously Matt Berry had gone to America and had some success with What We Do in the Shadows, the TV series.
Exactly. I think he had Hollywood friends, and through those friends he was probably able to get this made, but it could have been good, but yeah, it wasn't the best.
Yeah, but crucially, was Clem H. Fandango in it?
I guess I'm pretty sure he was. I kind of erased it from my memory, but I said he is an absolute standout of that show.
Yes, I can hear you, Clint Fandango.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, is this thing... So was Toast of Tinseltown, was this a BBC thing, whereas Toast originally was Channel 4? Was there something weird like that that went on with it as well?
It was on BBC. Not sure why, that's weird. But it was on BBC, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Moving on, and we're going to revisit some feedback around Coogan's Run, which I have to say from the outset, I've not seen, and there are kind of some lines being called out that I might not be able to do justice to because I simply haven't seen the show. Probably a good time to ask, has everyone else seen it? What's everyone else's views on this? Have you seen it?
I have a feeling I must have seen it, but I owned a copy on VHS, which tells you how long ago it was, so my memory of it is little to none.
I think I've only seen one scene of one episode, which I think is the same one that Tom has seen.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you.
Well,
guess of that.
I'll give it my best shot, and if I get it wrong, you can let me know. Anyway, Michael Brennan writes, Coogan's Run was a superb little series in its own right, highlights being Dearth of a Salesman with Gareth Cheeseman for the classic line, a wank, I think. Did I get that right? How did that performance go?
No, okay. Not good. You're not through to boot camp. Yeah. So basically, Gareth Cheeseman is left to his sort of own devices in a hotel room, and he basically goes, kind of looks around and just goes, a wank, I think.
Nice. So the classic line, a wank, I think. Hopefully I did that better. Well, so continuing with the correspondence, so look out for the hotel room. Is it the same room that was used in the future episode of I'm Alan Partridge? Cheeseman is post-Partridge, as the series was made in 95. The day-to-day was well before that. I say he was a cross between Sir Dansworth of Moodyshire and AP. Natural Born Quizzers with Patrick Marber was a great episode all round. Get Calf, I really enjoyed Paul and Pauline Calf in the context of this episode, and the excellent Video Diaries, which are absolute Coogan gold. The other three episodes are passable and have some lovely moments, but I think that those three would be your faves, despite the general disdain for Paul Calf. And I think we have been a little bit down on Paul Calf when we viewed it through the lens of 2023 humour. But hey, there's room for Paul Calf. But yeah, thank you for the note, Michael Brennan.
And following on, more correspondence about Gareth Cheeseman from Jonathan Brown this time. He says, having listened to your previous feedback episode, someone mentioned Gareth Cheeseman in Dearth of a Salesman as something you should watch as a link to Alan. I second this. Along with the similar character traits, it was written by Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews, along with Steve, which is a big link to I'm Alan Partridge. However, the main reason you should give it a watch is that I read somewhere that when they were deciding which Steve Coogan character to develop into their own show, it was down to Alan Partridge or Gareth Cheeseman. So who knows, now you could be doing a Cheeseman podcast and not a Partridge one. That is quite interesting, but they are quite... I wonder how many similarities there are. I think people have pointed out in the past the similarities between Gareth Cheeseman and Alan Partridge.
I think the kind of dress sense is the same, isn't it?
If you join us now, you're listening to A Wank, I think, the Gareth Cheeseman podcast.
Yeah.
We've dodged a bullet.
In another universe.
They wouldn't index that on Apple Podcasts, would they? So, yes, continuing with your feedback about other Coogan projects that we might want to cast an eye over, we're on to my pet favourite, Saxondale. Michael Brennan again says, Re-Saxondale, you will need a basic grasp of 70s rock bands to fully enjoy the series. I'm sure the DVD versions and repeats have been cut for copyright music tracks. Sort of takes away from the gravitas of the series when you have a Muzak version of Led Zeppelin. But do watch out for cameos by Matt Berry and Tim Key and his excellent next-door neighbour played by Darren Boyd, who is also Daniel Langford in McMorning Matters. It really is an excellent series and defo needs more attention.
I would also add to this, if there are any kind of Partridge fans out there that want to see it, we've often talked about the challenge of actually getting to see Saxondale. So it is on Now TV and it is played from time to time on UK Gold. So two options there if you want to see Saxondale and don't want to buy a DVD.
I think, didn't we discuss on the last batch of feedback episodes that it is possibly available on, was it Dailymotion? I think there are ways to get it without having to pay for Now TV as well, but... not for me to endorse that, just throwing another option into the mix. To continue on the Saxondale chat, so obviously this is something we were discussing, Saxondale and Coogan's Run, in our feedback episodes at the beginning of last series, series 14. So if some of this maybe doesn't make sense, we need a little refresher. That's the start of the conversation. 18 months later, here we are continuing this conversation. Andy Marsh wrote to us, would you consider doing a breakout episode, brackets, episodes, reviewing Saxondale, partly because of the Partridge crossover, partly because I've just seen Wally Banter in one episode. I mean, I'm assuming the actor that plays Wally Banter, not the character Wally Banter, unless if Saxondale is actually in the APU, that could be interesting. Would have to watch to find out, unless if, Adam, you can clarify.
It's been so long since I saw Saxondale, I honestly can't remember, but this is another good reason to go back to it, because I like the idea that that Wally Banter has a radio show in both universes. And I like to think that to imagine the music connection is such that Saxondale could be listening to Wally Banter. Meanwhile, Alan Partridge is setting up in the studio to go on after Wally Banter. But yeah, have to revisit to find out.
Some good APU kind of, well, universe building or Steve Coogan world building. I mean, yeah, I would definitely be keen to do this in some form, whether it's doing a couple of episodes overall or doing it episode by episode. But I think, you know, the reality is we're definitely going to be doing Big Beacon next. And then perhaps I think that's hopefully an opportunity to look at some other Coogan work. But it is kind of depending on whether there's any new Partridge stuff, because, you know, I think probably about a year ago we were probably discussing, oh, we've covered everything we can cover in the APU, maybe let's do Saxondale, and then Ice Tower Series 3 and Big Beacon happened. So it's kind of down to Coogan's work rate, I think.
Well, speaking of other Coogan projects, we've had a message in from Lee Smart, who says, in relation to other Coogan projects, have you considered an episode on Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible? I think it's criminally underrated with some great nods to classic horror. Jed, back me up. Keep up the great work. Now, I was not aware of this, have not seen it, but based purely on the artwork alone, which I found on IMDb, I highly recommend that we all watch this, because it does look pretty funny. It's Coogan kind of across, he sort of looks like a cross between Scaramanga, Nosferatu and me in about 5 years' time, I'd imagine. And it looks like he's struggling to focus his eyes as well. But yeah, I was genuinely in pieces looking at this cover. I've no idea what it is, but it never fails to surprise me, the kind of things in Coogan's back catalogue that I was just not aware of. So that is a great shout, Lee, and I will be watching that, and I'm sure Jed will back you up.
I'm not sure if I'm lining up the timelines here, but I wonder if Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible, there was a sort of spate around the kind of early 2000s of really good ensemble kind of parody pieces. So I'm thinking like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, Look Around You, like things like that, where it was kind of a surprisingly good hit rate of well-known comedy actors all kind of doing their bit to sort of subvert the genre, whether it's documentaries or kind of mystery or horror. So in my mind, this sits in amongst those kinds of shows, but I have to admit I haven't seen it, and I do suspect that perhaps it came before a lot of those.
And if you weren't aware, Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible was actually sort of an anthology series based on horror films, episodic, and I had it on DVD. I have to admit I'm possibly maybe watched it once at the time and haven't gone back to it, and obviously who owns DVDs anymore? It's been thrown out, so I can't remember much about it, but I do remember that cover that Nick is referencing, and it's safe to say that anything with someone boss-eyed will get Nick in absolute stitches. But I had an idea, and I thought, as Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible is a nod to 60s and 70s horror films, it would be great for producer Jed to chime in here with his one-minute series review, or one-minute episode review, or one-minute Jed's found a clip on the internet and watched it review. So please, take it away, Jed.
Welcome back to Jed's One-Minute Reviews. So Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible, it's a decent parody of classic horror anthologies, specifically the Amicus 1965 classic Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which was their first anthology-style film. Amicus went on to design their whole business model around the anthology format, producing the classic Tales from the Crypt a few years later. So Coogan's play on this format has him star as the titular Dr. Terrible, a cross-eyed man who looks like Kojak after a skiing accident, who tops and tails each episode with his musings of what you're about to see and what you've just seen. Each of the episodes does a good job in blending humour with horror tropes in a quirky and irreverent manner. With a runtime of only 30 minutes, each episode is a bite-sized adventure filled with absurdity and campy charm. The show cleverly satirises various horror subgenres, from haunted houses to werewolves, with a tongue-in-cheek approach that keeps viewers entertained. The comedic performances and witty writing make it a fun watch, fans of both horror and comedy, but overall, Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible really isn't for me. I think it's way too on the prosthetic nose. But if you want half an hour of playing the game, spot the comedian, then this is for you. I'm giving Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible 2 out of 5. See you next time on Jed's 1 Minute Reviews.
Thanks for that, Jed, although we haven't heard it in advance, so I'm just hoping you've not said anything libelous this time. Getting back into Coogan's film and TV past, we've had another person get in touch on the subject of Tropic Thunder.
Yes, so Nathan Shuttleworth got in touch by email, and he says, "Dear Tom, Adam and Nick, brackets and Jed, Have you seen the Reign of Darkness mockumentary created by Steve Coogan and Justin Theroux as a DVD extra for Tropic Thunder? It is a parody of the Hearts of Darkness documentary about Apocalypse Now, except for being for the film within a film of Tropic Thunder. In it, Justin Theroux plays a Werner Herzog-like filmmaker who documents the making of Tropic Thunder and interacts with its stars and crew. I thought it would be of particular interest to you since it gives Steve's character, Damien Cockburn, more screen time than in the film due to it being set before his untimely death. I noticed that a lot of Alan comes through in the character Steve plays, and I wondered if you all thought that as well, or maybe I've seen so much Partridge that any time I see Steve, I just think it's Alan. It's 30 minutes long and it's available on YouTube. He's shared the link. I did watch a bit of it earlier. I have to say, I am probably leaning towards the latter, where Nathan, you've watched so much Partridge that any time you see Steve, you just think it's Alan. He does have some Partridge mannerisms, but it's Steve playing a sort of like obnoxious film director, bit of a megalomaniac, bit of a wild one, and yeah, I just think it's the case of it's Steve. So immediately you think his mannerisms are like Alan because he's slowly morphed into Alan himself.
That's what I was going to say. I think you do have this issue with the later era Alan. Like the further you get, the closer him and Steve are becoming to the same person. So yeah, it is particularly in their speech and mannerisms these days that there isn't very much that actually separates the two anymore.
Moving on to other quote-unquote Coogan projects, I'm sure news has found its way to most of you that The Witchfinder was axed after one series. We obviously reviewed that as it was so Partridge adjacent, so you can go back and listen to our thoughts about the first series, only series now, of The Witchfinder. But yeah, sadly it won't be commissioned again. There's an article in the Scottish Sun which I thought was incredibly prejudiced. It opens with, Steve Coogan is probably wishing he'd stuck to Alan Partridge after another of his TV projects hit the skids. I mean, there is so much wrong with that sentence, I barely know where to start. I mean, firstly, it's not exactly a Coogan project. Yeah, it was made by Baby Cow, but he didn't direct it. I think he might have produced it, but, you know, it's not really a Coogan project.
I think
project.
He had a co-writing credits on a few episodes,
you know, he's not in it. It's not It's not a Coogan project, is it? It's a Gibbons project. Probably wishing he'd stuck to Alan Partridge. Well, he never stopped doing Partridge, obviously. He didn't stop anything, as far as I can tell, to do this, really. He did this as well as other stuff. There was plenty of other things he was doing at the same time. Another of his TV projects hit the skids. How many other projects? I mean, obviously, if you're Baby Cow and you're commissioning a load of comedies, not all of them are going to go on to have more than one series. Like, I just think it's very vindictive the way it's been written. BBC Two sitcom The Witchfinder, it continues, which aired last March with Daisy May Cooper and Timmy Key in leading roles, has been axed after just one series. And then it goes on to say, Tim Key, who is best known for playing Simon, Alan Partridge's sidekick, took the role of Witchfinder Gideon Bannister. So, I mean, not only are they trying to stick the boot into Coogan, I think quite unfairly, it's riddled with basic errors, as you might expect from an outlet like the Scottish Sun. But yeah, I'm quite sad about that. I did have a soft spot for Witchfinder. I would have watched another series. Interesting to see what they did with it next. I suppose it's kind of a concept that might be hard to spin into a second series. Ultimately, once Tim Key and Daisy May Cooper are somewhat friends, that's sort of the end of the tension.
Yeah, that was my kind of view on it, that actually, you know, I'm sure they would have wanted a second series, could have made it work, but in reality, it was written that it could have been just one episode, one series, sorry, and that actually would have been fine. I wonder if it suffered a little bit from kind of being pitched as a bigger show than it maybe had a right to be, and if it had been on at, say, 10 or 10:30 at night or in a different kind of channel maybe, then the expectations might not have been quite so high. But I think it can leave with its head held high. It's a great series and I need to rewatch it.
I think perhaps if they pitched it a bit more as, you know, this is 70% Detectorist, 30% Blackadder, that would have then it would have found its audience.
That's a very good summary. I think as a mix, I'm sold on that, and I don't think that's ever quite how it was really pitched, was it, when it started?
Yeah, broadly agree, would absolutely watch that. But now moving on from Alan's other projects, Alan's other projects, Steve's other projects, back to...
Always do that.
I always do it. Back to Oast House, and we've got some feedback on Oast House Series 1, all the way back to Series 1, blimey.
Yeah, and this is an interesting email from Tia Ministo, which in my mind is already starting to meld with Dr. Terrible's House of Horror, perhaps, as well. So Tia writes, Hello, chaps. I'm a latecomer to your podcast, so I'm still working my way through the episodes. Apologies if this has been solved already by some of your expert listeners. But when I was listening to From the Oast House, and I do believe this refers to Series 1, Episode 15, Alan recounted a story about a deeply unsettling blue movie, and I knew immediately what film he meant. A 1970s Hammer horror film called Lust for a Vampire. In 1988, or thereabouts, I watched it on my own on a dark autumn night, and it freaked me out for weeks. It was fascinating and really terrifying on equal measure, so I agree with Alan here. I think I owe my lifelong love of bad horror films to this film. The visuals really stuck in my mind for years to come.
So at the risk of overexposing producer Jed, if you have seen Hammer Horror 1970s film Lust for a Vampire, now would be a great time for a one-minute review.
Welcome back to Jed's one-minute movie reviews. Grab your garlic necklaces and prepare for a hilarious ride through the halls of horror with Hammer's own Lust for a Vampire. If you're looking for a movie that combines the suspense of the vampire flick with the unintentional comedy of a school play, then sink your teeth into this boobalicious gem. From the moment the sultry vampire strut to the screen, you'll be torn between laughter and genuine fear. But mostly laughter. Watch in awe as characters make decisions so questionable, you'll wonder if there was a script at all, or just LSD-fueled scribbles in the back of the Ladybird Book of Vampires. But fear not, dear listener, for amidst the calling dialogue and over-the-top acting that's more hammy than Bernard Matthews, there lies a glimmer of brilliance. Witness scenes so delightfully absurd, they'll have you shouting at the screen, "That's not how vampires work!" And the costumes. You'll be treated to an array of fantastic fashion choices that range from 70s chic to, did they just raid a South London charity shop or Spirit Halloween? So in conclusion, this really isn't up there with my favourite Hammer movies. Try Plague of the Zombies if you want to see what Hammer can do on a minuscule budget. But I give Lust of the Vampire 3.5 out of 5 because I can't remember what scale I used before because it's been ages. So now it's out of 5. Back to the boys, and thank you for joining me one last time on Jed's 1 minute movie reviews.
Thanks, Jed. Or not, no thanks, depending on what you actually said then. We'll find out in the edit. And I think this the thing about this kind of Hammer horror style film as well, I'm pretty sure that when we did cover Oast House Series 1 originally, we had some similar feedback. And I think, didn't somebody suggest it was a film like Lesbian Vampire Killers or something?
Yeah, that is ringing a bell,
but I couldn't find the exact note. So maybe we'll never know for sure.
Well, we've had more speculation and feedback on the Oast House, and this comes from Chris Payne, and he writes, "I've just been re-listening to some old episodes and heard the part where you were discussing Oast House Series 1, Episode 3. The Echelon dating agency set Alan up with a woman, and he was in a year-long sexless relationship where they would go on walks and put their hands down each other's pants." Great. On the pod, you didn't see the need for this and described it as a bit confusing. There was speculation that the woman was a prostitute and Alan didn't realise he needed to pay. I'm probably not the first person to make this point since the episode went out, but surely the key detail is that Alan put his hand down the back of her trousers and she put her hands down the front of his. In the words of Alan, looks like a lady, but really, it's a man. I'm still not sure I understand that story, but does anyone get it now after Chris has shone a bit more light on it?
Well, that story is implying that that Alan is with a ladyboy. He puts his hands down the back because have you seen the ending of Ace Ventura Detective?
I think perhaps there's a bit of overthinking going on here.
I think
what we're here for. This is what the podcast is about.
In order to overthink the overthinking, I also think that they've misquoted here. I believe the correct quote is "looks like a lady," but in fact, it's a chap.
There are two versions of the quote because I thought that was wrong as well. But I think I might have this the wrong way around. Someone correct us. I think in I'm Alan Partridge in the series, he says really it's a man. But I think in The Man Who Thinks He's It, I think he says
it's a chap.
Yeah. So I think there are actually two. And in one of the really, really early episodes of Monkey Tennis, we played in like a kind of like dance mega mix of lots of Partridge quotes.
That's where I was remembering it from.
And in my mind, it's like that they're both kind of intertwined. So I might have which way around it is wrong. But yeah, there are two versions. But I would say to this email, it's a bit like, well, it's pure speculation in terms of what we suggested when we talked about it, and what Chris is suggesting as well. It's a bit like, well, both are a bit weird, and it's a bit kind of obtuse, isn't it? Like, it's not definitive what's actually going on there with the joke, and you know that is part of the thing. It's perhaps it could be either of those things. And again, much like so many of these messages, we'll probably never know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And quickly moving on to Oast House Series 2 feedback. Paddy McGuinness got in... Oh, no, Paddy McGuinness didn't get in touch. Jamie Atkinson got in touch.
Paddy McGuinness got in touch to promote some very competitive holiday deals.
Jamie, Paddy, if you're listening, please do get in touch.
Jamie Atkinson got in touch regarding Paddy McGuinness. Paddy McGuinness, in his autobiography, said when he was still a massive Partridge fan, he had a couple of bad experiences with Steve, including the 2001 Comic Relief special, where he felt Coogan coldly ignored him. Carrying on, I'm guessing Coogan doesn't rate McGuinness, given there are jibes at him in both series of Oast House. Yeah, a little bit of bad blood between the two of them if they're, you know, sort of sniping at each other in their respective... Well, Paddy McGuinness in his actual autobiography and Steve Coogan through the medium of Partridge.
I'd love to know if this is because of some perceived wrong in the comedy worlds where they've overlapped, perhaps when Coogan is sort of in his ascendant around the same time as Phoenix Knights, or whether this is just that Steve Coogan just looks down on Paddy McGuinness and his sort of level of performer in the sense that he sees the comedy as more lowbrow, or he sees him as just, you know, that guy that did Take Me Out.
I mean, I would go with the kind of lowbrow option, because I think as well they inhabit quite different spaces in the comedy world, and I think the thing about Coogan's ascendance and Phoenix Knights, you know, Coogan won the Perrier Award in, what was it, 92 or whatever, or even earlier than that, maybe. So, yeah, I think in terms of their career gestations, Coogan's been around for much longer than McGuinness, so I don't think it'd be something like that. I do wonder as well whether Coogan genuinely has beef because of McGuinness doing things like gambling adverts and stuff, because I think there are jibes about that in Oast House, if I remember. So it might be very much a Coogan yes, Alan yes, for something like that. But I think without a doubt they're just in such different space in the comedy world. I think there is definitely an aspect of looking down looking down one's nose at him, perhaps.
So enough about all that. Let's talk animal verbs. We made a call out in reference to Oast House Series 2 Episode 3 Cowing a Fox, around permutations of animal verbs, but Jacob Saxton, our listener, was not content to leave it there. He writes, Dear Monkey Tennis, I would like to suggest that you can parrot a hound a parrot, goose a hog a goose, catfish a bee a catfish, a sort of a development of what Alan said, but fine to join in. I'd agree, Jacob, but I would say that you're in danger of frogging a dead horse.
Great. Great. Yes. Great stuff. Keeping on the Ace House theme, Isla Scott got in touch with us over email, and thank you, Isla, for incredibly typing up the complete transcripts for Ace House Series 1 and 2 and sharing amazing. With us. I mean, I dread to think how many hours that took because, you know, we're currently working through doing the notes for Ace House Series 3 or Series 2 Tranche 2, and it takes bloody ages.
Is this where we find out she did it with AI and it took about 6 minutes?
I don't think so. Not from what it's.
Oh God,
like
no! I'm reading ahead now. God, she really has put in the effort.
Yeah. So Isla writes, suffice to say, it's taken many weeks to do this, but I finally finished typing up a transcript for From the Oast House. Over summer, I typed up series one, and I've just finished typing up a transcript for series two, tranche one. It should make it a lot easier to double check how often he makes that I must try stand up comments, references to Schnapsy or Shapsy. No, wait, I've got that wrong. Shapsy or Schnapsy, SL. And since I went to the effort to do it, I thought the least I could do is share it with the other Alanites. Is that the agreed term? Not sure we have agreed a term for that. Also, I'd noticed the discrepancy regarding a replacement for Seldom. Given Alan doesn't reference having another dog in subsequent episodes, pods, so far anyway, I assume he hasn't replaced Seldom. I was pleased you mentioned it, though. It's not just me thinking that episodes contradicted one another. I also enjoyed your attempts at Monkey Tennis jingles. Good work, Jed, et al. Also, I hadn't realised the Oast House Eps had names until I heard you mention that on the pod. I found them on IMDb now. Nice one.
Yeah, absolute hats off there. I think we all know how much time it takes to type up notes. So fair play, Isla, and thank you. And very thank you. And a very thank you to our next listener. I'm going to try and pronounce this. Rajan? 1982, hopefully I've got that right. Either way, they write, "Hi guys, I have a theory that Katrina isn't real." Bombshell.
Bum bum bum.
Alan admits he's lonely. Maybe he's just invented his perfect woman. Also, he previously mentions two other neighbours. How many does he have? Also, Alan seems to have a preference for smoky women. That's women who smoke. I don't know what we think about that. Is Katrina real? One thing I will say is a little bit of a spoiler for what's coming next with the Oast House, which we will be reviewing soon, is my love for Katrina and the character Katrina is going up and up and up.
Is she basically your perfect woman?
She's great. She's great. She's got her head screwed on.
She smokes like a chimney. She drinks like a fish. And she's extremely right-wing. And it is all about that.
Imagine Liz Truss.
Great.
I did like that this person seems to think that it's absolutely out of the realms of possibility for anyone to have more than three neighbours. I mean, have you seen the TV show Neighbours? They've got loads of them.
Next up, Jack Dorm has been in touch by email and he says, "Hi guys, love the pod and I thought I would share something I noticed with you. In the Oast House Series 2, Alan describes his romantic novel set in wartime France. His cadence and way of describing the book sounded just like a Richard Madeley interview of him describing his own novel, which I've shared here. Give it a listen, and I think you will agree. As we all know, Madeley is more Partridge than Partridge at this point. Who knows if this is deliberate?" We should play in a clip of this, but just before we do, I have listened to it, and it is amazing how similar they are.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. So let's play in a clip of that now.
Presenter, author, and radio presenter, last heard on Radio 2 on Sunday, in for Michael Ball. Richard Madeley is here not to talk about radio or TV, but to talk about The Night Book, out in paperback today. Richard, welcome.
Hello, nice to see you.
Very good to see you. Now, why is it called The Night Book?
Ah, well, it's based on a secret diary that is kept by my, I would call her heroine, some people would say she's an anti-heroine. She's married to a deeply, deeply unpleasant man. He's a psychological bully. It never was meant to be that way, but that's how the marriage has turned out. And he treats her abominably. But she's a radio agony aunt. It's 1976, as you say, and she has a burgeoning career. She's very, very beautiful. She's called Meriel. But she has never shared with her listeners and her viewers, because she's on telly as well, that her marriage is poison. It's a car crash, because she thinks that if she does, then they won't trust her advice to other women. So her way out of this impasse psychologically is to keep the night book. And what it is, it's a secret diary, a fantasy diary. And when her husband's been particularly vile to her and left her in bits, by the time he's gone to bed and they sleep in separate rooms, she's ready to write. And I have to warn your listeners and hopefully my readers, if they get the book, that these are extremely graphic, short interludes of violence where she kills him. But that's the way she keeps her sanity. That's her release. As I say, it's set in 1976. That was the incredible hot summer. Do you remember
the summer
of 76?
Well, yeah, and I've chosen a song for the end.
Have you?
That brings back, will bring back memories of that year.
Because what I wanted, in all my books, I have a sense of time. I always set them in the past, because I like writing about the past, and a strong sense of place. So the first novel I wrote was set in the south of France in the early 1950s, very glam. The last one was set in the Florida Keys in the early 60s, the era of the Kennedys, again, quite glam. This is 76, in the hottest summer in British history, in the beautiful lakes. Now, I was a 19-year-old kid. I was a local radio reporter. I'd started in papers in London, and I drove to Carlisle for my first job in radio in May 76, just as this heat wave started. And the effect on the lakes was incredible. I mean, it was like being in the Italian lakes. You know, Windermere was like Como. It was just beautiful, and I'd never been to the lakes before, and I just couldn't believe how gorgeous they were.
There we go, and I think we can all agree that Partridge is Madeley, and Madeley is Partridge.
Moving on to some imagery chat around the series of Oast House. As always, we can always rely on our listeners to Photoshop accordingly when the occasion calls for it. In episode 9 of Oast House Season 2, you have Alan talking about how the other day he spent 4 hours on Photoshop trying to make his shoulders broader, his jaw squarer, and his beard pointier. And while initially pleased with the results, he went too far and ended up looking like a thin genie. Well, thanks so much to Andy McDonald, who has mocked up Alan's approximate Photoshopped image, which we'll share on socials, but we're all having a lovely chuckle looking at it now, which I appreciate. It's not great for a podcast listener, but just all the more encouragement to go on our social media, and then you can have a look at Andy McDonald's thin genie version of Partridge, which, frankly, I now can't unsee.
And continuing the feedback on Oast House Series 2, Stout and Ale on Instagram wrote to us, "Gentlemen, in this episode," and I'll be honest, I can't remember whether this is episode 3 or 4, we probably should refer to Isla's transcripts to get this right. They write, "In this episode, Alan says bastard cut file, not bastard cup final. A bastard cut file is the coarsest metal file, like one you'd hide in a cake if you're breaking someone out of prison. Okay, bye."
Great knowledge.
So that's a lot of prison outbreaks under his belt there. That was us getting it wrong, saying we thought it was bastard cup final, didn't we?
Which in hindsight makes far less sense than bastard cup final.
Moving on, we have a message from Love You Take, Love You Make, who's written in on Instagram, and they write, "Just putting it out there, putting butter on only one slice of bread is demented, and thinking that most of the population agree with his opinion is the deranged ramblings of a mentalist. Bye." And this, I think...
Do we need to recap what that's in reference to? Yeah.
Yeah, so this is in reference to the Oast House where Alan has a falling out, where his friend, God, is it like... I can't remember his name, is it Greg or something like that? Or Nathan?
Ronald?
It's Ronald. It wasn't Gregor or Nathan.
It's Ronald.
It's Ronald. Where Ronald's wife only buttered one side of the bread, and Alan disagreed with this, and there was a fierce and heated debate, but ultimately Alan...
No. I don't think that was it, wasn't it? He has a disagreement with Ronald about the almost like the quantity of the ham and the sandwiches stuff. The thing about buttering one piece of bread, that was Tom Stapp.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously...
Was it?
Leading into the next point, I was adamant that, well, not adamant, but I was like, basically, I only butter one side of bread when making a sandwich. And the reason is because she puts too much butter in the sandwiches.
That's it.
Isn't it?
She puts too much butter in. You're right.
Whereas I am actually on the other side of that, where I probably don't put enough in, according to 74.3% of our listeners who voted on this poll. But what I would say is, still, in my defence, that you have one slice of bread, you butter it, let's say it's ham and cheese, bang, bang, lovely stuff on that side. The other slice of bread, my mum makes a cracking piccalilli, and I don't want to put butter on the piece of bread and then put the piccalilli on there, because the butter's going to mix in with the piccalilli, and I don't want that. I want the tasty, delicious, tangy, zingy piccalilli flavour, so I don't want any butter on that, so I'll put all the piccalilli on the other side of the bread, and then bang, put them together, and then you've got yourself
a lovely sandwich.
That's
one very specific example. I think the general thing being that Tom Stab will only butter one piece of bread in the sandwich.
What I'm hearing is
let's review the evidence here, right? The thinking that most of the population agree with his opinion is the deranged ramblings of a mentalist, right?
It would
so
appear
you
that
are basically a deranged mentalist.
It would appear so.
And also, the evidence speaks for itself. We ran the polls on our socials. 74.3% on Twitter said yes, they butter both pieces of bread. And 76% on Instagram said yes. So, Tom Stapp, you are in the minority. You are bang wrong.
I have to say, the most startling thing that came from this poll is the fact there's 144 people willing to vote on it at all. I mean, what I will say is that the poll that you've included as evidence in this feedback document is from Twitter, which, as we know, is the platform for the deranged mentalists and conspiracy theorists.
This was before Musk took it over, so it was fine. If that's your argument, the percentage against you is even higher on Instagram.
One in four.
So where are you going with this?
I can't see that. That's not in front. I'm just talking about the evidence that's being presented in front of me that says one in four people agree with me.
Yeah, I mean, that is one way of looking at it, isn't it?
I imagine there were probably more people...
That's quite annoying, actually.
There were probably more people that would vote in your favour, Tom, but that because they hadn't had enough butter, they were too weak to vote. Also, in this economy, my butter is going further than everyone else's. I'm getting through half the amount of butter that everyone else is, and therefore I'm saving, and I can spend more money on things that, like Guinness
or Piccalilli.
And you really will spend that money.
No, I don't need to buy Piccalilli. My mum makes a cracking Piccalilli. I cannot
Are we still talking about this?
Yeah.
Are we still talking about it?
Okay, on to stratagem feedback, because we simply must cover stratagem. We're obliged to.
Do we have to?
David Driscoll got in touch and said,
at least the message is short about it.
Yeah. Strap in. Dear Dallander Shids, writes David Driscoll, I hope that you are all well. Thanks for the recent episode regarding stratagem on Amazon Prime. Like Tom Dark, I was unable to attend a live show and so only caught up with it on Prime. Unlike Tom Dark, however, I wasn't adding to the overpopulation of a dying planet. I just couldn't be bothered going to Dublin. Congratulations, I suppose, Tom. As a fop since Know Me Knowing You with Alan Partridge, I have to say that I found this new show very disappointing. I agree with a lot of the comments made on the podcast. The sound mixing is absolutely brutal. Most of the gags fall flat, and I really think that Gibbons/Coogan phoned this in. The conversation with Lynn, time travelling, brackets Christ help us, and the stage invasion, in inverted commas, are things that feel like clutching at straws on their behalf. I think there may have been a miscalculation regarding how much collective goodwill was lying about for live performances post-COVID. Sure, we were all starved of live entertainment from bands, stand-ups, etc., who received a rapturous reception when things finally opened back up. Goodwill and audience anticipation only carries you so far, though. You can't just churn out any old bollocks. That slot is already taken by Mrs. Brown's boys. Given the quality of Partridge since his resurrection, stratagem is a major misfire and is certainly one of the very few things in the APU that I won't bother with again. 2-1-10, a veritable foot pierced on a spike. Well, Dave, I think you were even more scathing than we were, and we were relatively scathing. It's definitely not in our top echelons of Partridge, but yeah, thanks very much for your thoughts, and as always, agree with your Mrs. Brown's boys.
Yeah, there's no disagreement there. We also have a message on stratagem from Adrian Bavister, which is a slightly different viewpoint. Adrian writes, I feel like I have to defend it, and it wasn't his best work. There were definitely bits that didn't work, but I still feel like you guys are way too hard on it. I do need to say I wasn't able to see it live and watch it on streaming. I do have some thoughts on all new Partridge material. I think Alan peaked very early in this 30-year period, and it's incredibly hard to keep that high standard up without messing it up. I think we go into new material with really big expectations and it's easy to be let down. What I do find is that on a second or third rewatch, those expectations have gone and it can be viewed for what it is, which is usually really great comedy. I mean, I think that's a very fair point. Our expectations are always super high going into new Partridge. And I think, you know, I think we'd agree with Adrian up to a point in terms of everything that has been new in the time Alan has existed as a character has been of pretty high quality. Until we get to stratagem, to be honest, I think it's easily the worst thing Partridge has ever done. You know, I think we all love things like Mid-Morning Matters, This Time, the books, Oast House, like they're all great. And I think all of those properties as well really do benefit from a third or fourth watch or listen as well. So, you know, I think definitely agreeing with Adrian on that point, but I would still maintain that stratagem is not good and it will not be getting any rewatches here.
I would say I slightly disagree with Adrian's point about saying how Alan peaked very early in this 30-year period. I mean, commercially, yes.
Quality-wise, I don't think that's true at all. And I think the reason that we go into new Partridge material with really big expectations is because since the Gibbons have been involved, the standard has been 90%, you know, hit. And I think we went into Stratagem with high expectations because we had no evidence to suggest that it was going to be anything other than really good. So, yeah, our expectations are high, but that's because they have set that bar so high. And I don't think necessarily it's because... I don't think it's because Alan peaked 30 years ago. I think he's consistently stayed very, very strong, and it maybe is just commercially peaked 30 years ago, as reflected in ticket sales.
Well, Jamie Atkinson has written in and keen to share thoughts on Stratagem. They write, "My favourite Alan is him bouncing off the regular supporting cast, but I understand it would be hard to get them to do a stage show. Even Simon Greenall, who did the comic relief shorts at the time, isn't in the 98 show. And Alan solo is hilarious when rambling to himself or doing documentaries with bad editing, which can't really be done on stage. So it's probably why they fell back on the old lecture format and why it didn't work." So another notch on the Stratagem not being great leaderboard.
However, contrary to that, our state dancer on Instagram got in touch and said, "I thought it was excellent. I was shocked to read all the negativity on IMDb. Regarding empty seats, I think a lot of fans could just not afford the price of the tickets. I'm friends with a few Partridge obsessives like me who have attended all of his live shows since The Man Who Thinks He's It in 97. And trying to book a seat towards the back of the Manchester Arena was over £90. So £180 plus booking fees for me and my wife to attend really was a bridge too far. In the current climate, they could have perhaps taken a socialist leaf out of Paul Heaton's book, who capped all of his ticket prices to £35 for all of his arena shows last December." You know, I think that's actually a very, very good point. I think, obviously, when you go into arena-level comedy, and to be fair to sort of Steve and the Gibbons and the promoters, agents, etc., there was a fair bit of production involved in Stratagem in terms of the set design and screens, etc., etc. So obviously, you know, that kind of needs to be covered, and obviously there needs to be a profit needs to be made by all those putting on the show. But it is still a good point that £180 plus booking fee is a lot for two people to go and see it. So it probably did impact quite a few people's decisions to buy tickets or not.
It does seem mad, yeah, to charge that much, especially kind of coming out of COVID, a lot of people in sort of slightly difficult financial situations. Big fan of Paul Heaton's attitude towards it, although I would ask you, what is Paul Heaton driving? And has that got some bearing on the fact that he's capped his ticket prices, whereas Coogan's charging 90 to 180 quid? But yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. The dig under the surface of Paul Heaton and you find all sorts of nice things that he's done for the public and for journalists and charities. So yeah, fair play to him. Moving on, Backpack Digital on Instagram said of Stratagem, "It felt much better live than it does on TV. Having said that, better is still not good. My favourite part of Partridge is nuance, and all of that was somewhat rightfully, you have to play to the people at the back, lost." I think that's true. I also think perhaps it's not where the Gibbons skill set lies. I wonder if actually the Iannucci era Partridge or the Coogan Iannucci written Partridge would work better as sort of broader arena comedy. Whereas I feel like the Gibbons excel, in the nuance, in the sort of sideways glances, in the blinking you'll miss it moments, in the going back and having to re-listen to Oasthouse, and you can't do that in arenas. And I think they swung hard at arena comedy and it was a miss, sadly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the almost like the first wave of Partridge, the late 90s Partridge, the Iannucci era, I think definitely worked much better in a live format. I mean, I've said this in the past, I still think the Partridge section of The Man Who Thinks He's It for me really holds up still, and I think that's probably the best live version of Partridge that I've seen across all the live shows he's done, because I think in that era you did have those more kind of slapstick moments. You think, you know, I don't know, like falling backwards over the sofa, like, you know, all those sort of things, impaling the foot on the spike type stuff, where you get these kind of bigger, more physical and or moments with a focus on the physical, which does, I guess, lend itself to
bigger arena style type venues and shows. The irony being, I think in the late 90s, like The Man Who Thinks He's It tour, that was a theatre tour. So he wasn't even doing arenas at that point anyway. Arguably, it would have worked better and read better with the crowd. And I think, I mean, this stratagem would have been the biggest venues that they'd ever done, because I think we went to see other less successful characters. That was, I think, Hammersmith Apollo in London. So, again, a step up from theatres, but also not like arena size. So it's funny how like the comedy that's being written has gone one direction, the size of venues has gone the other. So they've kind of missed each other in terms of how it should have, how it probably performed best.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that brings us to the end of our episode, but not the end of your feedback. So we will be back shortly with part two of a feedback special, which will be covering all sorts of things from Alan's attempts at veganism to the bombshell announcements and information around Oast House Series 3 in the run-up to us covering that series as well. As ever, we would love for you to get in touch with us with your thoughts, theories and questions. On Instagram, it's at MonkeyTennisPod, Twitter at ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod. The Monkey Tennis Hotline is down due to overwhelming demand, but we'd still love to hear your voices, so feel free to email us a voice memo and we may include that in a future episode. And if you can't be bothered to do all of that, for God's sake, at least do some of the podcast basics. Follow and subscribe, star in Spotify, tell a friend, share an episode. So we will join you for more feedback next week. But from all of us at Monkey Tennis, lovely to be back. Thanks and goodbye.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey Tennis?
Bring, bring. There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey Tennis?
Little piss, my foot on the spine.
With a chuckle.
Oh.
Monkey Tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey Tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes, and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Well, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey Tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.